Ayrım 12.
Sayfa 136. But any exchange of words, written or spoken, between men, which it would be appropriate to characterize as a contract or agreement or making of promises, can only be so characterized in virtue of there already existing some acknowledged and shared rule, according to which the use of the form of words in question is understood by both parties to be a binding form of words. Apart from such an already acknowledged and accepted convention, there could be nothing which could be correctly called a contract, agreement, or promise. There could perhaps be expressions of intention, but in a Hobbesian state of nature, there would be every reason to suspect that these were designed to mislead. The only available standards for interpreting the utterances of others would prevent any conception of agreement. Thus, Hobbes makes two incompatible demands of the original contract. He wishes it to be the foundation of all shared and common standards and rules, but he also wishes it to be a contract. And for it to be a contract, there must already exist shared and common standards of the kind which he specifies cannot exist prior to the contract. The concept of an original contract is therefore ruined by internal self-contradiction and cannot be used even to frame a metaphor of a coherent kind. If this is so, does not the whole Hobbesian case founder? It does. Hobbes wishes to picture a transition from a state of affairs where aggression and fear are the only motives and force is the only effective instrument to a state of affairs where there are acknowledged standards and legitimate authority. Clearly, such transitions are sometimes made. An authority comes to be regarded as legitimate and is obeyed, although originally imposed by force, in at least this sense. The question of who is the legitimate authority in any state and the question of who has the power there do not necessarily receive the same answer. It is quite clear that Dutch William and the German fools and oppressors called George, Byron's description for them, had the power in Britain after 1689, when the legitimate authority rested with King James II and his descendants. But this also makes it clear that the concept of legitimate authority has application only within a context of socially accepted rules, practices, and institutions. For to call an authority legitimate is to appeal to an accepted criterion of legitimacy. Where there is no such criterion, there can only be power or rival powers, as when an occupying army imposes its rules on a defeated country. And whether there is such a criterion or not is a matter of the acceptance by people in general of the criterion. De facto power can become de jure legitimacy. It was Hobbes' insight to see this. Indeed, every inhabitant of England saw it in the transition from the de facto power of the Cromwellian army to the de jure legitimacy of the Commonwealth. But what Hobbes failed to see was that the acceptance of an authority is in fact the acceptance of rules which give others and ourselves the right to act in certain ways, or the duty to act in certain ways, and that to have right is not to have power, while to have a duty is not to act from fear of the power of others. Hobbes equates having a right to with having the power to for at least two reasons. He saw correctly that authority is usually enforced by power, that authority often relies on the sanction of force. And he has such a limited view of human motives that he cannot provide any other explanation for acceptance of authority than the fear of such sanctions. but in fact an authority accepted only because men feared the consequences of not accepting it, or only because they feared the sanctions which it deployed could not function with the effectiveness with which most political authorities do function. Political institutions only have the stability they have because most men, most of the time, grant a willing obedience to their authority, and men do this because they see their own desires and those the satisfaction of which the authority safeguards coinciding. So does Hobbes. But he has such a limited conception of human desires that he necessarily has a limited conception of political authority. This limited conception of motives, desires, and activity ensures that most of the substance of human life goes unmentioned in Hobbes. We have a sovereign power so that our lives may continue securely. But what are we to do with our lives within the framework of order thus secured? Hobbes does say that men are inclined to peace rather than to continuance in a state of nature, not only by the fear of death, but also by desire of such things as are necessary to commodious living, and a hope by their industry to obtain them. But what is a commodious living? Hobbes has already said that there is no such finis ultimus, utmost aim, or summum bonum, greatest good, as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers, and his reason for saying this is his view that human felicity consists in a continual progress of the desire from one object to another, the attaining of the former being still but the way to the latter, and that men are driven on by a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death. This is a picture in which men are driven from desire to desire without the question, what kind of life do I want, ever arising. Hobbes' conception of the possible objects of desire is as limited as his conception of motives. Why? The root of the trouble is perhaps twofold. Hobbes' theory of language commits him to the view that all words are names, and that all names are names of individual objects or of collections of individual objects. Hence, all objects of desire must be individual. At the same time, Hobbes' determinism, with its theological reinforcement, for Hobbes believes in God, a material though invisible deity, not the God of Christian orthodoxy, but the author of nature, who expresses his will in the precepts which in fact govern our natures, leads him to treat our desires as given and unalterable. The criticism of our desires and their rational remolding have no place in the Hobbesian system. It follows that, inevitably, our desires are for one individual object after another, and thus desires cannot include the desire for a certain kind of life, the desire that our desires should be of a certain kind. Nonetheless, we owe to Hobbes a great lesson. This is that a theory of morals is inseparable from a theory of human nature. Just because Hobbes commits himself to a conception of a timeless human nature, he commits himself to an unhistorical answer to the question of what had destroyed political order in England of the 1640s, replacing it by the question of what social and political order as such consists in. But although this question is dangerously overgeneral, it is a type of question which increasingly invades and must invade the domain of moral philosophers. In particular, we cannot hope to ask and answer questions about freedom without specifying the nature of the social background to the moral life. but this is a class of question which Hobbes himself never asks. He discusses the freedom of the will only in order to stress that all human acts are determined, and he discusses political freedom only within the limits allowed by the limitless power of the sovereign. That this should be so perhaps requires explanation. It is remarkable that Hobbes should be as impressed as he was by the fact of civil war, and as unimpressed as he was by the declared and avowed aims of those who fought that war. But he was unimpressed, and he was so because his theory of motives led him to suppose that high-minded ideals were necessarily but a mask for the drive to domination. Consequently, he takes no stock in the appearance of freedom as an ideal and a goal, and in this he is blind to the most important social change in the history of this time. Certainly, the appeal for freedom often did mask religious intolerance and economic ambition. But did it always? Could men have in fact specified their desires and their objects of desire in the kind of social order that was then emerging without invoking the concept of freedom? That Hobbes can ignore this question reinforces the view of him as a backward-looking philosopher. He remains preoccupied with the vanishing bonds of a former pattern of social life which is falling apart. In private life, he himself was as concerned to escape dangers as to pursue more positive ends. When he saw the civil war coming, he went to France, the first, as he says himself, of those that fled. But if he feared death, he showed no signs at all of aspiring to domination. There is thus a crucial gap even between the values exhibited in his own quiet life at Malmesbury and those which he claims to pervade human life. Hobbes is at every point a contrast to his only peer as a moral philosopher in his own century, Spinoza. It is not just that Spinoza's life unites philosophy and practice, that Spinoza manifests that very impersonal love of truth which he proclaims in his writings as the highest human value. It is also that he brings together a set of concepts which are forward-looking in that they are going to be constitutive of much of later human life: freedom, reason, happiness. The state exists to promote positive human goods, not merely as a bulwark against human disasters. Religion is a matter of truth primarily and of the magistrates only secondarily. In the ordinary practice of pursuing moral judgments, Spinoza sees two errors embodied. The first is that our standard of judgment is arbitrary and capricious. When we criticize a man as defective in some way, as being or doing what he ought not to be or do, we judge him, so Spinoza argues, against some picture we have formed of a proper or ideal man. But this picture is inevitably an arbitrary construction, put together of our own limited and chance experiences. Moreover, when we judge a man, we say that he ought not to be as he is, in a way that implies that he could be something other than he is. But this implies an illusory notion of freedom. Since everything is determined, nothing can be other than it is. Our ordinary state of mind, then, in which we pass everyday moral judgments, is one of confusion and illusion. How so? Spinoza's answer is that ordinary sense experience and the ordinary uses of language which embody that experience are inevitably a matter of conditioning, of association, of blurred meaning. contrast the clarity of a mathematical system where every symbol has one clear and distinct meaning and where it is therefore unambiguously obvious that propositions are entailed by and entail what other propositions. Thought becomes rational as it approaches the condition of geometry, geometry now being conceived of as the embodiment of the only possible approach to rigor and clarity. The ideal of a deductive system is not, however, merely an ideal for knowledge. This ideal mirrors the nature of the universe. The universe is a single web in which the whole determines every part. To explain any state of affairs is to understand that and how it must necessarily be as it is, given that other things are as they are. If we try to envisage anything apart from the system, we are trying to envisage something whose occurrence should not be made intelligible, since to be intelligible is to be exhibited as part of the system. The name of this single system is Deus Sive Natura, God or Nature. There is therefore no good distinct from or apart from the totality of things. The attributes of God, infinity and eternity, belong to the single substance which is at once nature and God. Is Spinoza here simply an atheist retaining the name God? Or is he a serious pantheist? Novalis was to call him the God-intoxicated man. Plekhanov was to hail him as the ancestor of materialist unbelief. There is a twofold answer. The first part of it is that compared with traditional Judaic or Christian theology, Spinoza is an atheist. He believes in a single order of nature, and miraculous intervention is ruled out. The natural scientist need not reckon with supernatural eruptions or disturbances. The importance of this belief in the 17th century scarcely needs to be stressed. But nonetheless, Spinoza did not simply dismiss the theological vocabulary. He treated it, as he treated ordinary language, as a set of expressions which needed reinterpretation to be made rational. He is thus the ancestor of all those skeptics who have treated religion not as simply false, but as expressing important truths in a misleading way. Religion needs not so much to be refuted as to be decoded. What is the relevance of this to morals? The ordinary Jewish or Christian believer thinks of God as a being apart from the universe and of the divine commandments as external precepts which he ought to obey. Spinoza did not undervalue the utility of what he saw as this superstitious morality of external obedience for ordinary uncritical people. But the counterpart of understanding God as identical with nature is understanding ethics as the study not of divine precepts but of our own nature and of what necessarily moves us. Our nature as human beings is to exist as self-maintaining and self-preserving systems. This is true of the nature of all finite beings, which are subsystems of nature itself. Our unity as beings is disguised from us by our manner of thinking of ourselves as a unity of two quite distinct types of substance, body and mind. Those who believe in the duality of body and mind have, according to Spinoza, an insoluble problem on their hands as to how these can be related. But this problem disappears when we understand body and mind as simply two modes or aspects under which we have to conceive ourselves. We are a unity of body and mind. This is perhaps one point in the argument when we cannot avoid asking whether what Spinoza says is true. But when we ask this, we realize that the difficulty with Spinoza's system lies both in its form and in the use of some of the key terms. The form is of a deductive system in which all truths can be known by sufficiently careful reflection upon the meaning of the terms used in the propositions which express them. Consider Spinoza's claim that all men pursue their own interests, or his assertion that all events have causes. These look at first sight like factual claims, which could be refuted by citing counterexamples, whether that of a man who neglects his own interests to care for those of others, or that of a particular event without a cause. But Spinoza holds his positions to be true simply because they follow from the axioms of his deductive system, the axioms being propositions which he thinks no rational being could deny, because their denial appears to entail a contradiction. And the meaning of the key terms is such that we are left with no language in which counterexamples could be presented. Spinoza's difficulty here is that he wants his propositions to have the content of factual truths, but to be guaranteed in the way in which the propositions of logic and mathematics are guaranteed. These wishes are incompatible. Factual assertions have the content that they have because their truth excludes some possible states of affairs from being actual. If it is true that it is raining, then it cannot be the case that it is not raining. But the assertions of logic and mathematics are compatible with any and every possibility in the world of fact. They cannot be falsified by the world being other than they assert it to be. To say that they are true is simply to say that they are framed in accordance with the appropriate rules. I say nothing here about the statutes of such rules. This is why they possess the kind of certainty and the kind of clarity which Spinoza wishes his propositions to have. But he also wishes these propositions to be factual. He wants to be able to use his propositions as truths about man and nature with a factual content. Is the whole system then just a product of confusion? The only fruitful way to approach Spinoza's ethics is to ignore the geometrical mode as far as is possible. We have to treat Spinoza's contentions as a mixture of factual claim and conceptual analysis, and we often have to ignore obscurities rooted in terms which are never satisfactorily explained. So it is with Spinoza's treatment of the unity of body and mind. But what we can draw out from his scheme is an important attempt to understand the relation between reason, the passions, and freedom. For Hobbes, man is simply driven by his passions. Deliberation has the role simply of an intervening between passion and action as a middle link in the chain. The role of reason is simply to note facts, to calculate, and to understand. Reason cannot move to action. For Spinoza, this is a perfectly good description of man in his ordinary, unenlightened state. For in this state, human beings are systems interacting with other systems, but unaware of the nature and causes of this interaction. By these encounters, men are caused pleasure or pain, depending on what affected them at what time and the state they were then in. Objects which become associated with pleasure and desired, those associated with pain become objects of aversion. In pursuing pleasure and pain, we are therefore being affected by causes outside rational knowledge and control. And so also with those complex evocations of pleasure and pain, the emotions of pride, joy, pity, anger, and so on. But this non-rational realm only dominates us for as long as we remain unconscious of its nature and power. As we form adequate notions of our emotions, we cease to be passive in relation to them. We recognize ourselves for what we are. We understand that we cannot be other than we are. But to have understood is to have been transformed from what one was. One no longer sees oneself as an independent being confronting this, but as part of the system of necessity. To have seen this is to be free. Self-knowledge and only self-knowledge liberates. Why does knowledge free us? Because as we know more, we recognize that what we desire, hate, love, take pleasure or find pain in has been the result of chance and accidental association and conditioning. To know this is to break the association. We recognize that pleasure and pain arise from our power and perfection as self-moving, self-preserving beings. We do not blame others, and we do not blame ourselves. Envy, hate, and guilt therefore vanish. External causes are not hindrances, for if they are real, the wise man knows them to be necessary and does not treat them as hindrances. He is therefore not frustrated. The joy of the man who has freed himself through knowledge of nature and of himself as part of nature is happiness. Genuine virtue is simply the realization of this state in which knowledge, freedom, and happiness are combined. The possession of freedom in Spinoza's sense is of course compatible with being unable to do a great many things, provided that it is impossible that what hinders and prevents one should be altered. Spinoza thinks it impossible that one should rage against what could not be otherwise, for one can frame no conception of the impossible and hence cannot desire it. And if it is impossible that things should be other than they are, we cannot possibly desire that they should be. If we do so desire, we are irrational and our desire is not informed by genuine knowledge and adequate ideas. About this, Spinoza is clearly wrong. Knowledge is not a sufficient condition of being free, but it is often a necessary condition. I am not free merely because I get what I want, if I am not free to understand the causes and nature of my wants and reassess them. Spinoza's first great importance is that he sees the emotions and desires not as merely given, but as transformable. Aristotle has envisaged us controlling and ordering our emotions and desires, but for Spinoza, human nature appears even more malleable and transformable, and the largest transformation is that from being patients to being agents, from being those whose lives are determined by factors of which they are unaware to being those who are molded by themselves. The development of human powers becomes the end of the moral and political life. In this light, both politics and theology are reinterpreted. Spinoza agrees with Hobbes in seeing the need for the state as arising from the fact that all men pursue their own interests and seek to extend their own power. But for Hobbes, the reasoning which justifies me in handing over myself and my rights to the sovereign is purely negative. Only thus shall I escape being overpowered and killed by others. For Spinoza, obedience to the sovereign is justified because thus civil order is procured and men are left free to pursue knowledge and self-liberation. Spinoza agrees with Hobbes in equating having a right to with having the power to. But he has a quite different picture of what enlightened men have the power to do and desire to do. It is not just that they desire an end of hate, envy, and frustration in themselves, but they will be gravely impeded unless they can diminish hate, envy, and frustration in others. Spinoza's enlightened man is therefore cooperative with others in the search for knowledge, and this cooperation is based not on fear, as all cooperation in Hobbes is, but on a common interest in the goods of self-knowledge and knowledge. Thus, although Spinoza confuses having a right to with having the power to as much as Hobbes does, his picture of society is not disturbed in the same way just because he recognizes human goals of a different kind. The state is, for Spinoza, at best a means. Politics is an activity to procure the prerequisites for the pursuit of rationality and freedom. Spinoza is thus the first philosopher to make central to ethics two concepts which are defined to express the distinctively new values of modern society, those of freedom and reason. Chapter 11. New Values. Both Hobbes and Spinoza struck their contemporaries as outrageous innovators. To both, the label of atheist, which was used in 17th century Europe with almost as much accuracy as the label communist is used in 20th century America, was attached. Spinoza was expelled from the synagogue. Hobbes was attacked by the Anglican clergy. And just because they stand so far from their contemporaries, it is only in a relatively indirect way that they give expression to the common and shared dilemmas of their society. But the questions which they ask and the values which they embody, different as these are, soon become questions and values which inform a whole way of social life. And in a variety of ways, philosophical questions and practical questions come into a closer relationship. In a variety of ways, for differing social circumstances provide relevantly different contexts for the relationship. In France, for example, philosophy in analyzing the concepts of the existing social and political order, those of sovereignty, law, property, and the like, becomes critical of those concepts and so an instrument for criticism of the established order. In England, philosophy, in analyzing the concepts of the existing order, often provides a justification for these concepts. The differences between France and England are partly to be explained by the fact that the English social order provides many French writers in the 18th century with a model in terms of which to criticize their own society, whereas within England no such model as yet exists, although by the end of the century the French Revolution had enabled France to return the compliment. Nonetheless, in England we can mark the stages by which one moral scheme was transformed into a largely different one. We can use this history to partially explain how philosophical criticism can have quite different relations to social change in different types of period. There may be forms of society in which a variety of criteria are employed to justify and explain moral, social, and political standards. Do we obey the current rules and seek the current ideals because God authorizes them, or because they are prescribed by a sovereign with legitimate authority, or because obeying them is in fact a means to the most satisfying forms of human life, or because if we do not, we shall be punished or otherwise harmed by those in power? At a practical level, it may be unnecessary and irrelevant to decide between these alternatives. For if the standards which are in the end held to be justified seem to be equally justified no matter what criteria we employ in judging them, then the argument about the appropriate way of justifying our standards will seem to be of purely theoretical import, matter for sharpening wits in the schools, but irrelevant in the field or the marketplace. Social change, however, may bring theory out of the schools and not only into the marketplace, but even onto the battlefield. For consider what may happen in a social order where sacred and secular, church and state, king and parliament, or rich and poor fall apart. The criteria that used to return the same answers to the questions, what standards ought I to accept and what ought I to do, now provide several answers derived from the new competition between rival criteria. What God commands or alleged to command, what has the sanctions of power behind it, what is endorsed by legitimate authority, and what appears to lead to the satisfaction of contemporary wants and needs are no longer the same. That the argument is no longer the same as before may be concealed by the fact that the partisans of different criteria will naturally enough to attempt to redefine their rivals out of the field by trying to show with hopes that legitimate authority just is victorious power, or with the Puritans that what God commands is what we could recognize as satisfying our wants and needs if we were not so totally depraved by sin, or with the royalists that obedience to the king's legitimate authority is what God commands. Nonetheless, we can recognize that the criteria have fallen apart, and in recognizing this, we recognize the relevance of a class of question which is at once moral and philosophical. What kind of backing is logically appropriate to moral rules? What kind of warrant do they require? So far, we have encountered in the history of ethics at least three main types of answer. The backing of being part of a form of human life in which our desires and dispositions would be formed and trained toward the recognition and pursuit of certain goods, Plato and Aristotle. The backing of being part of a set of divine commandments, obedience to which will be rewarded and disobedience to which will be punished, Christianity. And the backing of being instructed as to what action will produce for us most of what we now want, the Sophists and Hobbes. Each of these answers specifies a different morality, and each of them specifies a different logical form and status for moral judgments. For the first, the key concept is good used functionally, and the key judgments are that certain things, sections, or people are good, that is, are well fitted for certain roles or functions in the background picture of social life, which this view always has to presuppose. For the second, the key concept is expressed by thou shalt, and the key judgments express consequences of reward and punishment. For the third, the key concepts are those of means to a given end, of our desires as they are, and the key judgments are of corresponding form. It is of course obvious, and has already been stressed, that it is impossible to combine and vary these three in all sorts of ways. Aquinas' blend of Greek and Christian is the most important, but how do we decide between them? Clearly, to lay down some logical form as the form of the moral judgment and to rule out others as illegitimate would itself be an arbitrary and illegitimate procedure. But what we can do is to note the theory of human nature and of the physical universe presupposed by each different view. And if we do so, the superiority of the Greek view, at least in its Aristotelian form, to either of its rivals appears plain, on at least two counts in respect of Christianity, and on at least one as regards the actions whose consequences will be most desirable view. Being with the latter, quite clearly our desires as they are stand in need of criticism and correction. Those who speak blandly of moral rules as designed to maximize pleasure and minimize pain have apparently never reflected on such questions as whether the pleasure afforded to medieval Christians or modern Germans by persecuting Jews did not perhaps outweigh the pain caused to Jews and therefore justified the persecution. That they did not weigh the merits of this argument is perhaps to their credit morally, but intellectually it means that they have ignored both the possibility of transforming human nature and the means available for criticizing it in the ideals which are implicit not only in the private heroic dreams of individuals, but in the very way actions may be envisaged in a given society. For we do not have to see Aristotle's ideal life, or the ideal of a Christian saint, or the ideals of chivalry as private intentions. They are the ideals implicit in the way of life of Greek gentlemen, or in that of the early church in its pagan environment, or in the institutions of knighthood and war. To detach these ideals from their social environment is to evacuate them of significant content. It was Karl Marx who remarked that what Don Quixote had to learn was that not every economic order is equally compatible with knight-errantry. But within their natural social environment, these ideals may be used to criticize not only our actions, but our actual aims and desires. Christianity shares with the Aristotelian view the advantage of not taking our actual desires as given, and it incarnates one moral ideal, which is foreign to both the other views, the ideal expressed by saying that somehow or other all men are equal in the sight of God. The dividing line between all moralities, which are moralities for a group, and all moralities, which are moralities for men, as such is historically drawn by Christianity. This doctrine in secular form, as a demand for minimum equal rights for all men and hence for a minimum of freedom, is Christianity's chief 17th century achievement, expressed centrally in the Manifesto of the Diggers and in some of the claims of some of the levelers. The left-wing movements in the parliamentary army in the English Civil War express for the first time secular concepts of freedom and equality, which break with all traditional forms of social hierarchy. But before we examine these new concepts, we must look at what happened to Christianity. Christianity's greatest moral weaknesses are two. First, the sheer extent of its metaphysical commitments. And second, the fact that it has to assert that the point and purpose of this life and this world is in the end to be found in another world. As long as men find this life inherently unsatisfactory, so long are they therefore likely to be interested in the Christian claims. But in so far as they do find adequate projects and purposes, their interest is likely to be weakened. And with the expansion of life, which is made possible by economic growth, otherworldly religions are, in fact, universally eroded. But even more importantly, belief in a God of any specific kind becomes increasingly a formality when it is not actually abandoned. There occurs side by side a process of intellectual criticism of religious beliefs and a process of social abandonment.